Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Tom Cran. I've got a feature for you I brought in from All Things Considered. Into your Thursday morning, how about a morning serving of appetites? Some food questions for you now. Is your chicken tough? Maybe your eggs are always runny. Maybe your gumbo's gummy. Do your souffles always fall? We hear you, and we've got some help. We've got science to help today. We're going to get answers to some kitchen questions for you this morning with two people whose days are spent perfecting recipes for the home cook. But don't expect quick fixes. There is a method to good food, the scientific method. And the people at Cooks Illustrated are involved in that method all day. And even if all you do is reheat or microwave, there's science behind that, too, and it's fascinating, so stay with us. We have Dan Souza and Molly Birnbaum. They are joining us from Boston. They are executive editors of a new book from Cooks Illustrated. It is a dense, lavish volume, and they're the people behind America's Test Kitchen as well on public TV. The book is called Cook Science, How to Unlock Flavor in 50 of Your Favorite Ingredients. Dan Souza and Molly Birnbaum, thanks for joining us here on Minnesota Public Radio.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we're excited to be here.
Here's what I'm going to do as I throw out questions to you. I'm going to throw them up and sort of jump ball. You guys decide which of you, I'm sure you're all well-versed, but you have your specialties, which of you think you'll handle the topic a little better, all right? Does that work?
Yeah, that works. Mm-hmm. The hard ones, I'll just make sure Molly does them.
Good. Okay. Molly, you get all the hard questions. And we want to get some listener questions and listeners involved right off the bat here. So we want you to join our conversation at nprnews.org/live or give us a call at 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. What have you tried to cook and just never gotten right? Or what triumphs have you had that you'd like to share? Let us know. Again, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. And first, I'm going to start with you, Molly. I want you to take us into the test kitchen and give us an idea about this process, because as I read it in this book, it is an elaborate process, and it is, in fact, very scientific. It's a laboratory, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. At America's Test Kitchen, we publish a ton of recipes all the time, and we always go into it using the scientific method. To create a recipe, what a test cook does to start with is cooks five different already published recipes that are already out there in the world of the one that he or she wants to do.
Okay.
Say you're doing a recipe for spaghetti and meatballs. Cook five different recipes for spaghetti and meatballs. We get to eat all of them and talk about what we like and what we don't like.
All
and
right.
From there, they get to hone in on one particular recipe that they create using the best of what they've seen, and we test and retest all of the individual variables of every part of that recipe until we get it to be perfect.
And by the time we get the recipe, whether we see you doing it on TV, on America's Test Kitchen, or it's in this book, and this book is a compendium of tips and recipes, how many iterations would you say it's gone through on average?
It can be up to 60 different iterations, sometimes more. I think there's one chocolate cake recipe that went over 100 times before we got it exactly right.
Wow. How do you know when you've got it exactly right?
Well, we're always asking for feedback from our readers. So when we feel like we have a recipe that's right, that tastes really great, that seems pretty foolproof, we have a panel of readers make it at home and fill out a survey. So we really know if people who aren't in the test kitchen hearing about it all the time can make it and love it at home.
Now, I also understand you do something called abuse tests. Tell us, it sounds like something from NASA for astronauts to go through. Tell us about those, Dan.
So, abuse testing is really important for us. We test a lot of products and equipment, and we develop all our recipes on that. So it's very standardized, much like a lab. But then afterwards, we realize that people at home don't always have everything that we recommend. And so if we're doing a recipe that requires a saucepan, we usually use a pretty heavy bottom saucepan that heats evenly. But we have some really thin aluminum pans that we keep around. So we'll try it in that and see if it burns, if we need to adjust the heat level. We also try it with ingredients. So if we're calling for dairy, we're like a milk, say, in a recipe, we generally would develop it with whole milk. In most cases, that works the best. But people at home might have skim milk or 1%. So we try it with that and see if the recipe fails or if it still works. And if it fails, we might have in the head note the script right above the recipe saying, you know, make sure you definitely use whole milk here or it's fine to use any kind. So it's the kind of stuff that you don't see a lot of people do recipe testing on, but we try to cover all of our bases so that when you make it at home, if you follow it exactly, you're going to get very, very close to what we make in the kitchen.
How do you use data to make great food, as you claim in the book?
So we use data in a number of ways. I mean, our primary piece of testing equipment is our taste buds and our mouth. So everything we taste, and we try and taste it blind or double blind. And when we can get quantitative data from that, we do in terms of ranking or scoring systems. But for this book, we also went a little bit more technical, and we got our hands on some kind of specialized equipment. One is a texture analyzer, which
I want to talk about these.
It's a very cool piece of equipment.
Most people don't have one in their home kitchen, a texture analyzer, right?
That's fair to say.
Yeah. What does it do?
Well, so the texture analyzer is used in industry for basically quality control. And so if you had a salsa that you wanted to be the same texture every time, you could put it under this machine and this little probe goes into it and tells you, okay, the texture is the way you wanted it to be. So that's its normal use. But we decided it'd be really fun to get it in and try it with some unusual stuff. So, we cook steaks to different temperatures and we put it under here and this little probe goes down and it basically mimics your mouth biting into it. But with no biases involved, no human error involved, it just tests that tenderness or gumminess or stickiness. It can do a lot of cool attributes. And so we put it to use in interesting ways. One was we wanted to quantify the difference between slicing a steak against the grain or with the grain when it comes time to carve it. And
okay,
so by grain,
right,
I mean
right.
kind of the orientation of the muscle fibers. You see it really well on a flank steak. And so if you slice with it, then you're biting against it. And that is a lot harder and a lot chewier. So when we did it, we found that it was like, I think it was something like four times.
Four
and a half times more tender to cut it across the grain and then chew with it that way.
How do you measure four and a half times more tender? This device tells you 4.5 times more
No,
450% more?
So basically, it's measuring force, the amount of force it takes to compress something or cut through something, and then you can compare those force numbers.
Okay.
And so it's grams of force. So it's a little bit technical, but the end result is kind of corroborating something that we've tasted or giving a really nice visual indicator that I think is a nice takeaway for people. So it hits home a little bit harder.
How many people are doing this, and how big is the test kitchen?
The test kitchen itself, in terms of square feet, is 2,500 square feet right now, which is pretty small for the amount of test cooks that we actually have working in the kitchen every day, which is around 50 people. So there's a massive amount of recipes being developed at any given time.
So when we see that in America's Test Kitchen and we see Christopher Kimball in the season we're in now, or Bridget, right? Or someone
Bridget
with
Julia.
Him. Yeah, Bridget and Julia, who will be the new hosts. When they're standing there and there are people working behind, those people are among the 50 people who are testing all this as they do the show?
Yeah, those are real test cooks, and they're actually doing their real testing work in the background of the show on a daily basis.
They're just doing it a lot more quietly than normal because we're also filming at that time.
Dan Souza and Molly Birnbaum are with us. They are editors behind a new book called Cook's Science. And we want to get some listeners involved here right off the bat. I have a lot more questions for you on the method and on some specific ingredients as well, because this is about how to unlock the flavor in 50 of our favorite ingredients. But first here on Minnesota Public Radio News, what if we take a few calls? And it seems Jerry in Rochester has been waiting and has a question. So go ahead, Jerry.
Hi. First, I want to say I love America's Test Kitchen. I have the cookbook and I use it all the time for pretty much every recipe I do. But
awesome.
I have a heck of a time cooking ribs because they either come out like, if I smoke them, they come out like jerky. I don't know when to wrap them, and I don't know how to keep them moist.
So did you say that you don't want to wrap them?
I usually, if I'm doing them in my smoker at home. I have an electric smoker and it works great. But I do a dry rub, and then I don't know at what point in their cooking to take them out and wrap them.
Okay.
So that they stay moist.
All right, ribs, Dan.
Ribs. So low temperature is your best friend for a cut leg ribs that has a lot of connective tissue. So if your smoker is running around, you know, 225, 250 and doing good smoke production, then that's great. You're actually getting most of your smoke flavor in the first, let's say, hour. When the meat is cold, more smoke will condense onto it. And once it gets to a certain temperature, it's really not going to pick up a whole lot more. So what we often do in the test kitchen and, you know, barbecue competitions would frown upon it is we would spend probably a couple hours in the smoker to get that smoke flavor, and then we'd move them inside. And we like to do a wrap at that point, and it goes into a low oven, which is going to be more consistent than your smoker. And the wrap, what that does is it traps moisture, and so you don't get evaporative cooling, and it gets you over what they call in the barbecue world the plateau, which is when it can sit around 160 degrees or so for a while, and you really want to get over that. So the wrap can get you there a little bit quicker. It's also going to keep more moisture on the exterior, and it can dry out a fair amount if it's uncovered and smoking the whole time. So I would bring it in, and you're looking for about 195 degrees internal temp to be tender, but not too tender for ribs. And that can take, you know, maybe another couple hours. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but another couple hours in your oven, and then you'll be ready to go.
And Jerry, Jerry's still with us, I assume. Are you doing beef ribs or pork ribs, and what difference would that actually make?
I assumed pork ribs.
Yeah, I'm assuming too. But you tried both, you said, Jerry?
Yes, I've tried both, yeah. And I failed epically with both of them.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no. I'm sorry to hear that. Have you tried our recipes in the book? I don't know if your book has barbecue rib recipes specifically.
I'm not sure if I've looked at – I haven't looked at the barbecue recipe. I cooked my entire Thanksgiving dinner based off your book the last 2 years with resounding success and
awesome.
Perfection, but I have not tried the I've not tried the rib recipe yet.
Yeah,
I'm going off of what other friends have said.
Oh, no, you can't trust your friends. You got to trust us.
I know, right?
You got to trust the method.
Yeah, no, definitely. I would check them out. We have a ton of different rib recipes now in terms of St. Louis style or baby back. We even have beef rib recipes that will be a little bit more specific than what I just told you. But in general, that's kind of our method. We spend some time to get smoke and then bring it in where you can control it a bit more in your oven.
Hey, Jerry, we're all coming down to Rochester for Thanksgiving, and you have to dazzle us. Is that all right?
I will totally accept that challenge.
Okay. Thanks for calling today.
We'll
I appreciate
there.
It. We're talking with Dan Souza and Molly Birnbaum from America's Test Kitchen. They're with Cooks Illustrated. Their new book is called Cook's Science, How to Unlock Flavor in 50 of Our Favorite Ingredients. And we're taking your calls as well, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. I'm Tom Cran in for Kerry Miller, and it's a morning edition of Appetites with our pair from Cooks Illustrated. And I want to get back to method here. And here is one thing, and I noticed it in your omelet recipe. You say the key to perfect omelets is basically separate the whites from the yolks, and then you treat them each differently. And it gets very elaborate. And I think some people might be put off by that. So are you saying this is the only way to do it, or this is the optimal way to do it? Molly?
Well, this is not the only way to do it. Of course, there are many ways to do omelets and work with eggs.
Mm-hmm.
We came up with the optimal way to do it for our particular recipe for a fluffy omelet in this book. And we separate the yolk and the white because an egg is almost like two different ingredients at one. They both operate differently. They change at different temperatures. So it's super hard to use them together. The white starts to solidify around 145 degrees and ends at 180 degrees, while the yolk solidifies between, I think, 150 and 158 degrees. There's
okay.
a big difference there.
Yeah. Now, but I'm thinking of the classic Julia Child episode, which I've seen again recently, where she sort of whips up the omelet, the eggs, in 60 seconds. You know, she just beats them a bit, throws them in the pan, and sort of jerks the pan around in the right way, and there they are, 60 seconds. And
mm-hmm.
and I'm wondering, though, if As you do this and put these together, do you have these conversations with each other that, you know, this may produce the optimal result, but it's just going to be too complicated for a lot of cooks? Does that ever occur in the conversation?
Yeah, I mean, we want our recipes to be something that people want to make, for sure. And when we go through the recipe process, maybe the steps that come together to create the absolute perfect, most delicious, amazing thing ever are just so complicated that no one would want to make it. In which case, we go back to the recipe, look at it again, figure out ways we can make shortcuts without getting rid of any of the flavor and end result.
So
yeah, I think that recipe specifically, that's for a fluffy omelet, which is a really interesting style where you actually whip the egg whites and then you fold everything else in, so you get this light, airy product.
Right.
The recipe you're talking about from Julia Child is a classic French style omelet.
Yeah.
We have a recipe for that too. And you're right, that comes together in probably 60 seconds. It's really, really quick.
So the fluffy omelet is a little more like a souffle almost.
It is like a souffle, and it's pretty amazing, I have to say. It's a delicious recipe. It's totally worth separating out the yolk and the white.
And that's a question. You get to another point there, and I wonder at what point do you decide, okay, this is delicious, but we can do another run of this, another iteration, and get it, I don't know, 1% better, 0.5% better. Is there a point where there's a point of diminishing returns?
Yeah, I would say there definitely is. You know, I mean, we work on deadlines, so we have to call it someday. At some point, you can work on a recipe for too long. But we work really collaboratively. So Molly and I's team, the cook science team that we head up, and we have a new website about cookscience.com, where we're doing some really new stuff. We have a really small team of people, and we're constantly tasting together. And, you know, we decide what we like, and we go forward with that, and we hope that people out there will really like it. And we get great feedback that they do. But absolutely. I mean, I could test a recipe for way too long, I think.
We
have to stop at some point. But we're always in pursuit of perfection. But, you know, we know that there's no such thing as perfect.
Now, tell me the difference between taste and flavor, because you say there is a difference. And then my follow up will be, how do you quantify that?
That is a great question. There is a big difference between taste and flavor. Taste, technically, is what you perceive on the taste buds in your tongue and in your mouth. And that's salty, sweet, bitter, sour, and umami, and nothing more. Flavor is what brings all of your senses together to create the perception in your brain of how this tastes. Is it delicious? Is it not delicious? It's the nuance of the herbs and the spices. It's the texture. It's the sound of it in your mouth while you're eating. Flavor is a pretty comprehensive term.
And so you have that meter there, the chew-o-meter or whatever you put the beef through,
the texture analyzer.
Yeah. Right. Okay. That I can understand, you know, pounds of force against a piece of meat and all. Mm-hmm. But there's no taste-o-meter, really. This is 20% tastier than, right? That's where you start getting subjective, right?
Right. I wish there were a taste-o-meter. Yeah. But it's a very subjective sense flavor. And it really comes down to what you like, what you grew up with. And all of us at America's Test Kitchen, we spend all of our days thinking about what is delicious. What do we like? What does someone else like on our team? And that's what's so collaborative about what we do. It's really talking about what is good, what we like, what we can make better, and how to relate to other people's sense of delicious, too.
Yeah, and I think one thing we did really well with the Cook Science book is we dove into all these 50 ingredients and tried to get really deep. And we give so much information about them in terms of how they work and the experiments that we did that at home you can use that information to make the ingredient the way you want it to be. Like, for instance, we did a lot of work with kale, and we know kale salads are really popular these days. A lot of people tend to overdress them because kale can be kind of bitter, so you're trying to cover up that flavor.
Trying to kill the flavor of the kale is what people are doing. And this is a thing with me. I know kale is supposed to be very good for me. I know it's of the moment. It's the trend.
Right.
I just don't like it. And I'm wondering, because of the bitterness. And have you found a method that actually renders it tasty?
Yes. So I would say that kale in and of itself is tasty, but it can be a bit bitter. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times, you know, it's overdressed. It's just covered in Caesar dressing. And like, what's the health benefit there? So we found that there's a technique of massaging kale, which is essentially breaking down the structure a little bit manually. You can do it with your hands. You can do it with a rolling pin inside of a Ziploc bag. And by doing that, you're basically creating a lot of flavor. You're damaging cells, and you get a lot of the flavor coming out. What we found is if we did that first and then rinsed it, like chopped it and then rinsed it, as opposed to washing it first, we could actually wash away some of those intense bitter compounds. And so we get a kale that is a little bit more tender and also a little more mild. So we can dress it as we would kind of normal greens. So it's order of operations. It's not difficult. It's it's kind of what you'd normally be doing. It's just doing it in a smarter way.
You basically wash the kale flavor out of the kale.
A little bit of it, yeah. Not all of it, but yeah, exactly. Some of that harsh stuff. Because, you know, the flavor, the interesting thing about kale is there's not a lot of flavor going on until those cells are damaged. And that's true for a lot of brassicas. It's in the brassica family. Mm-hmm. So we can create some of that flavor and then get rid of some of it. And it's just a little bit milder.
Have some callers waiting patiently here. Let's get to them with Dan Souza and Molly Birnbaum from America's Test Kitchen. Their book is Cook Science, How to Unlock the Flavor in 50 of Our Favorite Ingredients. And to John in Minneapolis. Hi, John.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Good. Hey, I just wanted to thank you guys. I kind of consider myself sort of a cooking nerd. But I just want to say that because of America's Test Kitchen and Cook Science, like in the past several years, I swear that my cooking has gone from like a zero like a 10 just following your recipes. And I
That's fantastic to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like, just for example, like the call that I called a little bit ago talking about the ribs. Well, I had never made ribs in my entire life until a few weeks ago. I followed you guys' recipes and it was not just good, it was like knock your socks off. So I just wanted to say thanks and
nice.
I follow you guys and I'm a big fan.
All right, John, thanks.
That's great to hear.
Thanks so much.
0 to 10, he didn't tell us if that's like an arithmetic scale or a logarithmic scale. Let's hope it was logarithmic, exactly. Eleanor in Maple Lake is dealing with making, angel food cake on a very large scale. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi there.
Hi.
So what's your question?
Yeah, so I have a part-time job cooking in food service. So the other day, I was requested to make angel food cake to serve 160 people, which sort of seems like maybe not the best idea on the face of it, but this was what was on the menu. So I made my angel food cake, put it in the oven, took it out of the oven. Everything looks great. I went to serve it, and the bottom third was just like some sort of hard gelatin. The top two-thirds was fine. It was maybe a little tough, but it was totally fine. But myself and the other cooks just looked at each other, and we had no idea what went wrong there. I was wondering if you guys had any insight on that.
All right, Eleanor, thanks.
Wow, that is a mysterious question. Was this one large angel food cake, or was it a bunch of small angel food cakes?
It was, I made the batter all together, and then I poured it into a couple different pans. So it was more like, sort of like how you would lay out a brownie, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
In several different pans, but all made from one batch of batter.
So, and were you using the classic tube pan that you use for angel food cake, or this was actually in more of a brownie
It was
pan?
It was basically a brownie pan, yeah.
All right. So what do you think happened there?
I think there's potentially two things going on. One is you're mixing a big batch, and so if you don't mix it really well, like a really well emulsified batter, that can be a problem for cakes across the board. An angel food cake would be no different. So I'm wondering if you're used to mixing a smaller amount, so you mix it a little more thoroughly. When it's on a larger amount, it might be a little more difficult. So that's one. And the other is if you're using a different kind of pan, the reason that tube pan works so well is the heat can actually get in on the inside. So the cake is baking kind of from both sides at once. And that's really important to give it good lift and help it set before it starts to collapse on itself. And so if you have a bigger area, that the center of the cake is going to be a lot harder for it to heat up and kind of rise and set at the same time. So I feel like it could be maybe even both of those factors combined into one is my best guess. Did the batter look as nice and emulsified as normal?
Yeah, it looked pretty good. It seemed to be fine, I guess. But yeah, the shape of the cake was definitely not what the shape of an angel food cake would normally be. So
yeah, I would definitely say it's an issue with the pan. There's a reason everyone uses a tube pan for an angel food cake, not just its pretty look. It's a heat thing.
All right, Molly Birnbaum and Dan Souza are with me, and we're talking about their book and the general topic, Cook's Science, How to Unlock the Flavor in 50 of Your Favorite Ingredients. We'll continue with more calls and more questions for them here on Minnesota Public Radio News in just a moment on this Thursday morning. But first, we get this check of news from the newsroom. Here's Mike Mullen. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Tom. The National Hurricane Center says Hurricane Matthew has now strengthened to a Category 4 storm. An emergency management official in the Bahamas says there are downed trees there and power lines, but so far no reports of significant flooding or casualties from Hurricane Matthew. At least 16 deaths on the storm are being blamed of the storm in the Caribbean. Matthew is now taking aim on states like Florida and South Carolina. Governor Nikki Haley says parts of two counties along South Carolina's northern coast are being evacuated. Haley warned anyone in an evacuation zone not to take the orders lightly. She says surge from the storm could be as high as 8 feet and affect not only the coast but also areas farther inland. So far, Haley says 175,000 people have evacuated from the coast. The Russian military is warning the U.S. against striking Syrian government forces, saying it's ready to use air defense weapons to protect them. A Russian Defense Ministry spokesman voiced concern about media reports alleging that Washington is considering strikes on Syrian troops. And police say a St. Louis County police officer is dead and a suspect critically injured after an exchange of gunfire. The pre-dawn shooting took place in Green Park, a small middle-class community in South St. Louis County. Police say the shooter had been the subject of a disturbance call to police. 54 degrees, partly sunny right now in the Twin Cities. More news ahead on Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 10:43.
On Morning Edition, Kathy Werzer asks the questions that need to be answered.
What risk do these men pose to society?
The risk depends, obviously, on the form of counseling and treatment they receive.
Tune in weekdays from 4 to 9 on Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Tom Weber. Next hour on NPR News, a new report details what it calls a crisis in the Twin Cities rental market. You'll hear about that, along with a big idea being bandied this week at a big invasive species summit in St. Cloud. Should we just close off some lakes entirely to let them recover? Also, Paisley Park open this morning for tours. We'll get an update. All of that at 11.
News coverage of business and the economy is supported by Allianz Life Insurance Company of North America, helping more than 1 million Americans get closer to their retirement goals. Allianz, for all that's ahead. Online at allianzlife.com.
I'm Tom Crane in for Carrie Miller this morning here on Minnesota Public Radio News, and we're talking science in the kitchen. Cook Science. We're talking with Dan Souza and Molly Birnbaum. They are executive editors of a new book called Cook Science, How to Unlock the Flavor in 50 of Your Favorite Ingredients. Think of it as our appetite segment here on your Thursday, and you get a chance to call in and ask questions as people have been doing. But first, I want to throw another one here to Dan Souza and Molly Birnbaum, and I'm sure a lot of people have been talking and asking about this. But in the past 6 months or so, news that the man behind Cook's Illustrated all these years, Christopher Kimball, a lot of people know him from the TV show as the host. He's the person who it was the animator and founder of so much of the work that you do. And he's left the organization. He won't be part of the TV show from the next season on. And I'm wondering what other changes are coming. Does that signify a change in any of the methods and the way you proceed there at America's Test Kitchen?
Well, what Chris founded the company with was a real burning desire to answer the question of why and how things work in recipes. And that is exactly what we do and what we will keep on doing forever at America's Test Kitchen, always getting to the bottom of how things work, why things work, and creating recipes based on that. Some changes that are in the future for us at the company. Dan and I started a new brand called Cook Science, which is connected to the book, which we're really excited about, which is on cookscience.com. We launched a couple months ago, and we are all digital and totally free and having a really fun time publishing different stories about the science of food.
So that is a new...
Go ahead,
Dan.
Yeah. Sorry, so we also have a really exciting news about... our location. So as Molly said, we have a pretty small kitchen. I mean, small for us. It's 2,500 square feet. We are actually moving to a new location in Boston Seaport in an old Army barracks building in dry dock. And we're going to have a kitchen that's probably four or five times that size. We're going to make that move in August of next year, which we're really excited about as well. So expanding in that sort of way. And as you mentioned, Bridget Lancaster and Julia Collin-Davidson are the new hosts for the 2017 season. And I'm doing a bunch more science segments and more recipes on there. We've also got a few new cast members coming on. So there's some really exciting stuff happening
at the
company.
It's all really exciting.
Now, tell me, who are your primary people you hear from in the audience? Are they more science nerds or are they more people who love to cook?
Can you say nerds on the radio like that? I don't know if that's
yes,
fair.
You can.
Yes, you can. Okay. So I would say it's a huge mix. It really is. We get a lot of people who just want to put a really great meal on the table for dinner. We get people who love diving deeper into the nitty-gritty science stuff. And what's great about the Cook Science book is it kind of has all of that. We've got over 300 recipes in there that if you just want to make a really great dinner, you can do that. We've also got these awesome essays that do a deep dive. Molly talked to so many different experts and researched them so thoroughly so you can really understand what's going on with apples and their structure and their history. And then I did a lot of test kitchen experiments. So for each ingredient, there's an experiment that I do a deep dive to understand it a little bit more. So that kale one we were talking about is a good example. We did some really cool stuff with scallops and knowing how to buy the right scallops at the supermarket. And the biggest, the most important thing is that you ask for dry scallops. There's dry scallops and wet scallops, and they won't always be labeled that way. But dry scallops are essentially just shucked from the scallop. It's just that abductor muscle, and that's what they're selling, and that's it. Wet scallops have been treated with phosphates, so various chemicals that in and of themselves aren't bad, but what they actually end up doing is increasing the water binding capacity of the scallop, and they actually pick up a lot of water during storage. And what that means is you're buying scallops, which are really expensive, and you're paying for water at the price of scallop meat. And it can also leave a little bit of a chemical aftertaste. So we did some really interesting experiments where we actually treated scallops with these chemicals to see what they did, and we tracked their moisture loss as we cooked them. So dry scallops are what you want to buy, and we have really good backup for that now.
Dan Sousa is with us and Molly Birnbaum from America's Test Kitchen. We have another call here, Jamie in Chaska, who has a complaint, and it involves one of the words that I hate when it comes to food. So, Jamie, tell us what your issue is.
Texture. I have tried making ice cream in my own homemade ice cream maker, and it always seems to come out really grainy.
Grainy. See, I hate that. Grainy in food, right? You seldom want grainy in food. But
right, you never want that.
Yeah. What's going on with Jamie's grainy ice cream?
Well, that is a good topic. We launched cookscience.com, our new website, with a huge story about ice cream. And to report it, Dan and I went for a week to Penn State, where we spent 9 days learning about the science behind commercial ice cream, and then came back to the test kitchen to develop recipes for ice cream for the home cook, which Dan did, and he did a great job. So I'm going to let him take the science of this one.
The biggest thing with making ice cream is controlling water. So if you have a lot of water and it churns very slowly, you get large ice crystals, and that feels really grainy on your tongue, and that's not pleasant. Commercially, they make ice cream. They control the water in a number of different ways, and they freeze it very fast using powerful freezers, much more powerful than what you have at home, and that creates very small ice crystals that our tongues can't detect. So the recipe that we have up on cookscience.com right now for we have four different flavor variations, but they all use the same ingredients and the same science. We use some non-fat dry milk powder, which ups the ratio of protein, which helps to bind water and decreases the amount of overall water in the mix. We also use some corn syrup, which adds viscosity and can prevent iciness as well. And we also use a little bit of cornstarch. So, you know, when you make a pudding or something like that, it thickens up. That's because it's slowing and trapping water. And that's really important for freezing. So if you pop on over to cookscience.com and try the recipe, there's no way that you can get graininess. I worked on that recipe for months, and that was my goal, is to make it really work for a home ice cream maker. as opposed to something that the professionals have.
And these recipes are delicious. There's a strawberry ripple ice cream that I could eat for every meal until I die and be very happy.
And she would die pretty quickly, but it would be a good life.
Exactly. It sounds like a good way to go. Well, we've just posted that at mprnews.org/live as well for Jamie and anyone else who's interested in that. And I want to move right along here to Anna in Shoreview on line one, who's got a question for the pair we have. Our editors are test kitchen experts, so go ahead. Do you have a question for Dan and Molly?
I absolutely do. I'm a big baker, and I've been baking with my 14-year-old teenager for many years, and she just this summer was diagnosed with celiac disease, so all of our wonderful Cook's Illustrated recipes have kind of gone out the window. So I was wondering if you guys had any plans to do any kind of testing for alternative flours that we need to use, because we are sorely lacking. All of our taste and flavor actually comes out like cardboard.
All right.
Yes. Yes. Gluten-free cooking is super difficult. You're in luck, because we have actually published two cookbooks already, How Can It Be Gluten-Free, in which our book team tackled all sorts of recipes, finding the best way to cook them gluten-free. And we developed a flour blend using alternative flours that includes tapioca starch, rice flour, a whole bunch of things, that when you use that in place of flour in our recipes, it is really remarkable how wonderful these recipes are, and they're totally gluten-free.
Really? All right. So the flavor doesn't suffer. Is it different than bread that that we would be used to with a more conventional flour? Is it a different but equally delicious flavor, or does it mimic the flavor?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's a delicious flavor, and it often mimics the flavor of the original.
Yeah.
What you get when you're cooking with wheat flour is you're forming gluten, which many people have an allergy to, and that's a protein that forms a structure when it's hydrated. And that structure is what gives bread's lift. It traps in air. It gives it its real kind of network and structure and makes it taste and have the texture that it does. So cooking gluten-free, the difficulty is finding other flours that can create structure without having the gluten in it. And with some creativity and cleverness, this flour blend really does the trick.
Yeah, and I don't remember, I'm not positive about this, but I think the second volume is more whole grain-based. So we tweak the blend so it's more like a whole wheat flour, which I think would add more flour and more flavor if that's what you feel is lacking.
And I want to follow up on that with a recipe that caught my eye in the Cook Science book. And you said that when it came to pancakes, wouldn't whole wheat pancakes be better? Now, a lot of people, I have to eat more whole wheat these days than white flour. And a lot of people their heart might sink when they hear that. But you make a really good case for the whole wheat pancakes. What is it about the whole wheat flour that makes a good pancake?
Well, this is really interesting because what Molly was just talking about with gluten, like gluten is so important for breads, and chewy rustic breads, you need that gluten in there.
Right.
And it gives nice rise to bread. But with pancakes, you actually really want to limit gluten. You want something that holds together but is really, really tender.
Mm.
And so whole wheat flour has this problem in terms of gluten where the bran that is still included in there, which is so nutritious, can actually damage the gluten. And so if you made a loaf of bread with all whole wheat flour, it wouldn't rise as high as one with white flour because it has that other stuff in there. But when it comes to pancakes, it's actually a benefit. So you get that gluten is damaged a little bit, so you end up with something that's a little bit more tender. And you can actually work it a little bit more. Like if you accidentally stir it too much, you don't have to worry about it so much. You won't overwork that gluten and make them tough. So we find that pancakes are actually a perfect place for 100% whole wheat.
And potentially
healthier. It's
actually
much more flavorful, too. Whole wheat flour has so much flavor to it. So these pancakes really are quite delicious.
You can add more syrup, right? Because there's so much flavor that you can add 3 or 4 times as much syrup and you still feel healthy.
Which is what delicious is when it comes to pancakes.
And butter. You can add so much more butter, yeah.
Well, if it's some people might say, is there any other kind of syrup? But if it's real maple syrup, well, how hard could it be bad for you? Because it comes from a tree, right? It's totally
exactly.
natural.
So
right, I like that reasoning.
You like
yeah.
that reasoning? Okay, it's got, mm-hmm. yeah, it's gotten me to where I am, health wise. I have another question for you here. Tristan online says perhaps a silly question, but given the content of the question, I think there's nothing silly about this. And how does one go about getting consistently good grilled cheese, without one side turning to charcoal? Tristan says.
That's a good question. I don't know that we have a grilled cheese recipe in the book. I can't.
Yeah, I don't recall one
off the top of my head. No, but so just good method for grilled cheese is low and slow. So I think a lot of people think that to get browning, you need a hot skillet, and you could even start it in a cold skillet. You know, put your butter or mayonnaise on the outside of your bread, build the whole thing, put it on over probably medium low heat, and you can even cover it too, which they do a lot at diners. You could put a lid over the top if it's got some sides on it to stand above it, which would help a little bit. But if you just go low on the first side, flip it over low on the second side, you'll get the browning to be good by the time the cheese is melted.
Yeah, and you want to use a good melting cheese, a young cheddar, an American cheese, something that melts really nice and smoothly.
Well, I hope that's satisfying for Tristan when it comes to grilled cheese. A couple of minutes left for Dan, Souza, and Molly Birnbaum, and I want to ask you each about your path into this. Was it through science or food? Dan?
So I'm definitely from the kitchen. I went to culinary school, and I worked in restaurants in Boston and New York, and really loved it. I always had a lot of questions about the whys behind what I was doing, and science was a great way to answer them. And when I started doing recipe development, it became just crucial. Understanding ingredient functionality, and it gets you a long way in terms of perfecting recipes. So that's where I come from.
Molly?
So I have a slightly strange story in coming into food science. I've always loved food. I wanted to work in kitchens. But about 10 years ago, I was in a car accident, and I hurt my head and lost my sense of smell.
Oh, my goodness.
And without smell, flavor is almost impossible. So nice. I couldn't cook. I couldn't work in food. And I was fascinated and a little horrified, but mainly fascinated with what it meant for my sense of smell to be gone. The smell came back very slowly over the course of about 7 years. And all that time, wow. I started reporting, trying to answer questions about what was going on here. What is the science of the senses? How does it work? And that really led me into science journalism, which I've been doing ever since. And I've always loved food, so food and science journalism together was a perfect match.
Molly Birnbaum, what a fascinating story. And Dan Souza, thanks so much for being with us here on Minnesota Public Radio News. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Dan and Molly are the editors behind Cook's Illustrated's book, Cook Science, How to Unlock Flavor in 50 of Your Favorite Ingredients. And I'm Tom Cran, in for Kerry Miller on this Thursday morning with a little morning helping of appetites.